Welcome to Hope Beyond the Badge, a podcast that brings awareness, inspiration, and conversation together for first responders, families, and others interested in mental well-being and first response. New episodes weekly with your hosts, Jay Bailey and Linda Kokoros. Jay is a father, a military veteran, worked in the fire service for 18 years, and carries a diagnosis of PTSD. Linda is a mom, a wife, a certified life coach for first responders, and a suicide loss survivor of a first responder. Let's talk about it. Today we have Vance Rowe joining us on the podcast. Vance is here representing Yoga Rescue. Prior to becoming a yoga teacher, Vance worked as a police officer for more than 20 years. He then found yoga at a time when he was struggling with his own mental health issues, which included a toxic work environment, career-ending injury, and poor coping mechanisms that included abusing alcohol. Ultimately, Vance's story shows the power of resilience and why Vance wants to use yoga to combat first responder and military suicide. So, he founded Yoga Rescue as a way to do just that. Vance, thank you so much for joining us. We know that there's a lot more to that story, and we're really looking forward to hearing all about it. So first, if you wouldn't mind taking a moment.
Thanks for having me, first of all. I appreciate your time.
Thank you. Share with us, Vance, a little bit about yourself. If you want to introduce yourself to our audience.
Oh, definitely. So my name is Vance Rowe, and I'm currently from Baltimore, Maryland, but grew up there and just everything south of 12th grade, I should say. Sorry, got a little brain fart there.
That's okay.
Went to college outside of Philadelphia at a place called Westchester, and I am currently residing in Ocean City, Maryland, which is where I did my police career as well. And we live here with my wife and our three rescue pups.
Oh, wow. Nice. So Vance, you're a police officer. You were a police officer a long time. You're retired now, right? Tell us a little bit about that. Like, how did you get your first start in as a police officer? If you don't mind,
we can
go back there into that.
Yeah. Let's talk about it. So, I have humble roots, we'll say, and I say that because I was 19 years old when I got into my police department, and I was a meter maid for two summers. So I wrote parking tickets, I towed cars, I did traffic direction. I knew I wanted to get into law enforcement, but I just wasn't old enough yet. That we had to get to 21. So that was my foot in the door. So at 19, after my first year at college, I worked the summer down in Ocean City in a busy resort town. And so then I turned 21 and I went through our seasonal police academy, which is an abbreviated 4-week training program, certifies you to work at Ocean City for the summertime.
Yeah.
And then I worked for the next three summers still while I was in school. And when I got done school, I worked that following summer until I got picked up full time. So in total, I had five summers under my belt by the time I got hired as a full time police officer.
Wow.
Two as a cadet and three as a summer cop.
So was that something like even in college or in school, right? Was that something that you wanted to do? Like, where did the inspiration come from?
So I can tell you, all right, so I have a couple memories. The first one is, I can't tell you how old I was, but I was maybe like 12 or 13 years old, and I was in Cub Scouts at the time, and I may have been younger than that, but we took a tour of the Baltimore County Police Department in Woodlawn, which is like right about where I lived, and I was just like fascinated with it, and I always thought it was interesting. And then like the next thing that I really remember is, when I was in high school, which I got out of high school in 95, if you remember the movie The Fugitive, that was really big. And I remember watching Tommy Lee Jones, and I'm like, I want to do that.
Yeah.
And so I went to college actually as a political science major, thinking that I was going to go into federal law enforcement and I was going to like hunt down bad people.
Yeah.
Truth be told, I work in Ocean City. After spending a lot of summers here as a kid, and I kind of liked the local feel more, So I just never, I changed my major to criminal justice. I actually did my college internship in Ocean City working for the police department. And you know, you do things based on feel sometimes, and that just felt right. And that was the thing that I just stuck with. And then I was there for my entire career.
Wow. So when you got on, right, as that young, right, I know you had like 5 years, you said, working the summers under your belt, right, before you got hired as a full-time police officer. So did you end up having to go through an academy?
I did, yeah. So at the beginning, when we do this abbreviated academy where it's like 4 weeks in length, the only thing it lets you do is work in Ocean City for the summer. So it's about a 200-hour academy. And later in life, I actually, my job at the police department became recruiting and training those little baby cops and doing backgrounds and stuff like that. So no, when any police officer gets hired in the state of Maryland, honestly, probably every state, but what I can talk about is the state of Maryland. You go through a 6 month, for me, it was 22 weeks. It was 22 weeks in 2001. I think they're probably at like 24 or 26 weeks at this point. I mean, it's 6 full months of school, Monday through Friday, you know, like 8 to 5, a lot of running, a lot of pushups, a lot of
training.
Taken.
Yeah.
But you have to pass a mess of tests and firearms qualifications. Yeah. So that's the process, but that's 6 months of your career right there spent just in the police academy.
Yeah. So, and you got to do that. Now, when you went through that and you passed, obviously, right, because you got hired by Ocean City, right? What was that like for you, like, as a young, because I've heard, we've interviewed a lot of police officers, right, and a lot of first responders. What was that like, that feeling like for you, you know, having the uniform on, that first day really as a full-time police officer on the job? Do you remember that?
So you feel like you're kind of like a grown-up at that point, right? and so when I went to the police academy, I actually went through with a different agency, and that was with Salisbury City Police, and they're about 30 miles away from Ocean City. But I got hired there knowing that at some point I would, what's called lateral, take my certification from one department to another.
Transfer, yeah.
So, I was there for 14 months. So I did my 6 months in the police academy. I did 14 months on the road, and then I came to Ocean City in August of 2002, which was always the goal. You know, I knew I was never going to stay there.
Yeah.
I actually can remember when I got my, when I finally got like my final letter and like, hey, we're bringing you aboard. Here's your swearing date and stuff like that. My, she was my girlfriend at the time. She's my wife now. She had actually made all these cute little signs and put them all over the house. And like our little lab had like a sign around his neck that's like, my daddy's an Ocean City cop. And I mean, it was this is what I had been working for an incredible amount of time. So it was like dream come true.
Yeah.
And, you know, I threw myself right at it. And I was like, all right, let's get to work. And what I didn't say before is we're a little different in our geography and kind of how our population is made up. And the reason I say that is from May through October of every year, we are an incredibly busy resort town because everybody wants to come to the beach.
Yeah.
But then there's a dramatic off season then too. Well, for that on season, we hire a lot of summer cop people that were like me.
Yeah.
At the time we were like doubling our force just to help police the town. At the time, you know, you have this 10-mile barrier island and it might have 300,000 to 400,000 people on it, on any given weekend. Mm. And every one of them was drunk. So that meant that I,
you were very busy.
That meant I had stuff to do.
Yeah. And it was that like, so you were very familiar with that because you had done a couple of summers there. So you knew what to expect when you actually.
Not only did I do a couple summers there as like a cadet and a summer cop, but my grandparents bought a condo the summer that I was born.
Yeah.
And it's a 2.5-hour drive from Baltimore to Ocean City. And I spent a lot of weekends and I spent like a lot of Augusts with my grandparents.
Yeah.
There's a lot of pictures. My aunt just gave me a big bag of pictures last weekend and there was a bunch of photos of me. I'm like, what, 8 years old? I got this big mop of hair and Scopes pictures, if you're familiar with them. Yeah. So I would have those every year. So I put those up every once in a while. Those are usually a big hit.
So you were living the dream, like, you know, actually, yeah. you know, being a police officer in a town that you practically grew up in, right?
Yeah, yeah. For sure.
And you're living.
I mean, that was that's just what I wanted. Yeah. I got exactly what I wanted.
Yeah. So being a police officer, what was that like for you? Like, when did, I mean, you're 22 years as a police officer, 20 years in Ocean City, right? Mm-hmm. You know, the feeling I'm getting is a really good feeling from you, right? When you're describing that, this is what I wanted. Mm-hmm. But being a police officer, right, things can start getting heavy quickly.
Yeah, they can.
Share with us a little bit about that. Like, when did you started noticing, or where was there things that you started noticing in yourself that were changing? Or okay. were there some calls that you remember that stuck with you that sort of hit you a little bit differently than others that you couldn't shake okay. off?
So I'm going to answer that in a couple of different pieces.
Yeah.
So the first part, when I started to notice changes, and when I started to, it was the grind of it. It was every summer. I told you that, like, from May to October.
Yeah.
We would work. So our typical shifts were 4 10-hour shifts a week. We would mm-hmm. work a minimum of 5, and most of us would work 6, especially I was a very proactive cop. And I mean, I was young, so yeah. I was willing to work whatever. You know, my wife was very appreciative.
Yeah.
You know, the term that she would use, and like people laugh about it, but it's kind of sad all in the same token, is she would say that she's a summer widow, and she would literally lose me from the middle of May until the middle of July, because that's how much I'd work. I'd be home maybe one night a week.
Yeah.
So terribly yeah. unfortunate part is I lost a lot of friendships in there, like people that I had talked to for a long time, because they keep inviting you to stuff and you keep saying, I can't.
I'm working. Work. Yeah.
And right. And it just sucks. And then there's people just stop asking. So it's kind of isolating in that way. And I was working like all night shifts. So I was working from 10 at night to late in the morning. That's just tough.
Yeah.
Anyway. So interestingly enough, when you talk about what affected me mm-hmm. and what's the stuff that really had impact on me, calls never did.
Wow.
I mean, and it's not that I didn't see terrible things. It's not that I haven't had to do, you know, something that maybe I didn't want to do. Mm. The stuff that affected me had far more to do with kind of how we would treat each other. And I mean, like inside the agency. And, you know, I'd come from this football background where I'd played football all through high school and all through college.
Yeah.
You know, where you have to have 11 people kind of pulling for the same common goal in order for you to win. Mm-hmm. And it just made no sense. And it still makes no sense to me why, you know, you have 10 people trying to move in this one direction and you have somebody trying to undercut you, or, you know, trying to take your legs out. And it's just stupid. And mm-hmm. that's the stuff that bothered me. And people allowing personality conflicts and stuff like that to kind of get in the way. It just was a just kind of like a shitty way to live. So I actually had I'll fast forward a little bit. When I get to 2012, I get promoted to corporal. So I'd been a police officer for close to 10 years at this point. And in those 10 years, I got to do a lot of different stuff. I spent half of my time in our admin. So what I mean is I would travel to schools and I would talk about what it's like to be a cop, and I would try to get people to come down and apply and work with me.
Yeah.
I would end up doing their backgrounds. I would end up training them, which that was kind of like my wintertime job. And then every summer I'd go back and I'd work patrol. Now, I swear to you, I remember having this thought at a point, like, I want to be reliable. I want to be dependable. I want to be the guy that people come to when they have a problem. But I'm going to tell you, be careful what you wish for. My one buddy will call it the curse of competency. If you show people that you can do something, you're going to be saddled with it for a very long time. And that's what started to happen to me, that people would be like, can you do this? And I thought, I never would thought about myself. I always thought about those other people. So I always said yes. And I didn't think you could ever say no. So I would just take on more and more. And that was to my detriment, to the point of like not sleeping or whatever. I was willing to put myself out for whatever.
So does that
in order to make somebody else happy.
Just want to clarify that. Was it like sort of you basically what you're trying to describe is you were burning yourself out?
Oh, hugely so. So yeah. I was working, you know, 60-hour weeks, and I'm being told by shift lieutenants, they're like, listen, I know we have other cops on the shift, but if we get anything serious, it's yours. I don't trust the other ones. I want you to handle it. Okay. So that means I'm the one that's going to stay late, and I'm going to be the one that goes and does all the paperwork. And then very early in my career, I get recognized by our police union as someone that is kind of like a rising star, for lack of a better word. Mm-hmm. And they were like, we're going to get you involved. We like how you're made up. And so we're going to get you involved. So I get on the executive board of our local fraternal order of police within my first 2 years. And wow. Then I was on the board for the next 10. And so the best way to put it is, so I have this regular job that I'm going to all the time. And then when I wasn't at work, the stuff that I would do was all work related. Like I didn't do other things. I didn't, I stopped going to the beach. I stopped kind of working out. That's when drinking would really kind of amp up. I didn't recognize it then. I really didn't. It's not until much later than that. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to kind of go up until like 2012, 13. And when I get promoted to a corporal, so now I'm a first line supervisor, and I really start to see, it's just like the personality of your police department. Like you're trying to take care of your people, but then you're taking these requests and you're putting them up into like leadership, and leadership is just, I don't know if it's like lazy or if it's vindictive or if it's some combination of those two things, but nothing could ever get done. And the answer was always, well, we've never done it that way before. Come on. you telling me that we're never going to evolve as a people?
So there was things being suggested and then it was sort of like brushed aside. It wasn't taken seriously.
Every time.
Yeah.
So I become our agency's first polygraph examiner in 2013. And I went to polygraph school, which I will still tell you is the toughest school I've ever been to. 12 weeks on an army base, and you go to school for 6 days a week. And when I come back, what's great is, you know, I look at it as an opportunity. I got to build our polygraph program. So I want to talk about the first two years that I do this. So we're trying to hire 100 cops every single summer, and every single one of them needs a polygraph test. That means that I would see probably 200 plus people for us to be able to get to 100, because the attrition rate was so large. And what was starting to happen to me is I was working 60-hour weeks from October to April. So there's 6 months. And then I'd go back to patrol and I'd do it again. So I never got a break. And so it was constant. I had a really poor relationship with my supervisor at the time, kind of contentious. And then when I started to learn about polygraph, everybody has seen TV shows, everybody's seen movies, and there's bright lights and people are like, tell me the truth.
Yeah.
and I'm not going to tell you that it's not completely false, but there's a lot of Hollywood drama in there. The thing about polygraph for me was, and the thing that started to affect me was, there's an awful lot of bad things that have happened to people in their life that they've maybe never talked about. Yeah. And I was the first one that they were telling, because it came up during the polygraph test.
And the questions you were asking them. Yeah.
Right. So I was less of a police officer and more kind of like a therapist, and some of them were harder than others. And so those things I started to kind of internalize and I didn't necessarily recognize it, but it just got heavy. Like I felt like I was carrying somebody else's emotions. And then there's an awful lot of people that unfortunately try to get into the police world that have done some pretty terrible things to other people, especially. And that's the other ones that were starting to affect me. So I had all of those things that were kind of around me. And when I talk about this publicly and when I do presentations, I usually talk about this like a storm. And the reason I do that is because, listen, a storm is it's a couple different layers. There's usually like some rain, and then there's some wind, and then maybe there's some lightning and thunder. And that's how it came to me that I'm having this, you know, busy life in just trying to manage these hours. And then, you know, you kind of get hit. All right, now we're going to have you carry this.
Well, the storm was,
we're going to make it a little bad, a little worse.
That storm was starting to form right there when you were working all those hours, right?
Yeah.
And it just carried over.
I didn't know it. I mean, like from the time that I'm a baby cop, from the time I'm like 23, I've been watching people work like this for years. And I thought, this is what I'm supposed to do. And I have to do it as a young cop because I have to pay my dues. And that's the way it was when I played football in high school and in college. And I just thought, this is the way it is. I just never thought that there was a different way. And I actually was having this conversation at work earlier today. In fact, I used to kind of make fun when I would see people leave. And they would be like, yeah, I'm going to go work, somewhere else. Cause I can work like Monday through Friday, 8 to 5. I'm like, you're only going to work 40 hours. What's wrong with you?
Yeah.
And I mean, what's wrong with me?
Yeah.
That, you know, it's almost like work became an escape. Like I needed that, just to keep going. And that's what was validating me as a person. And
yes.
So, all right. So if you take what was going on around me in this storm, I get hurt in late 2016, and I had been working 60-hour weeks the entire summer. I'd worked 6 days a week from May, and we got into October 1st, and I fell off my police bike, and I whacked my knee on concrete, and it ended up tearing my patella tendon in my left knee. And so what ends up ending my police career is that I have nerve damage from, they don't know what, either the fall, the surgery, the immobilizing, something.
Yeah.
And it makes my left foot burn all the time. So it's just kind of dumb. Like I haven't worn socks in like 7 years,
wow.
You know, because anyway, so there's this 2 year period after I get hurt where I'm kind of in this like no man's land and nobody really knows what to do with me because I can't be a cop, but we don't have a medical retirement. So what do we do? So I'm just kind of like limbo, just kind of like sitting around. I closed my workers' comp case in 2019, still no resolution. And it's not for a couple more years that something gets worked out. Now, let me tell you about this. So it's probably a wrap. For some reason, when they told me it might take 2 years for the nerve to regenerate, I have in my head that by the fall of 2018, I'm going to be okay. And then I'm not. And that's really when my alcohol abuse probably went absolutely haywire. And I'm not going to tell you I developed a drinking problem. I probably had one since I was in college. I just did not have a very healthy relationship with alcohol. Oftentimes it would usually
Jay is
end
smiling.
Up with me being,
he's relating
being
with you.
Drunk. I get it. So that comes to a head, finally in the end of 2019, when my, wife actually videotapes me and acting like an idiot. And she showed this to me the next day. And, I was like, I don't want to ever have this conversation again. I was so deeply embarrassed. And so I didn't intend to stop drinking. I just was like, I'm not going to drink today because I don't want to ever have this conversation again.
Yeah.
But what ends up happening is one day becomes 2 days, 3 days, and then it becomes a week and then a month. And so now here we are, it's a little over 4 years later and I still haven't had a drink and I have no desire to drink anymore. And we actually have started recovery groups and things like that down here. I want to back up for 1 second though. So prior to her confronting me about the alcohol, 2018 was pretty rough year. And these are the points that I'm starting to have these thoughts of like taking my own life. And I don't tell her immediately. And it takes the suicide of a local cop in November of 2018. That's what scared me enough to finally speak those words. But it had been going on in my head for the better part of a year at that point.
Can you talk about those thoughts a little bit? What was going through your head?
In the beginning, it starts as you'd get in bed at night and I'd close my eyes and I would be like, I hope I don't wake up tomorrow. And it's just like, it would be so much easier if I'm just not here. And that then progresses to, all right, well, if I'm not just going to pass away in my sleep, then maybe I need to do something that's more overt. And that's when I actually had a plan of what I was going to do. Mm-hmm. I dealt with people in mental health crisis for a lot of my career. I ended up being one of those go-to people. Mm. And I could always connect with somebody. And my first question to them, always after, are you feeling like you're going to kill yourself? Mm. Was always, do you have a plan? And if they told me yes, okay, so this is pretty serious. You've thought this out. So I didn't have a day in mind. I didn't have a time of day or anything like that. I had a place. I had a way I was going to do it. And I finally, a cop that I worked with in Salisbury City, he was 27 years old. And this is November 2018. His name's Aaron Hudson, but everybody called him Bull. And I mean, like, enormous person, not just in stature. I mean, he was a big dude, but like his personality, and he was infectious. Mm. And like, this guy, how is it that this guy did it? And that's what, I go to his funeral, and I think it was either that night or the next day. I finally had to break down and tell my wife. I'm like, I don't know what's wrong. I don't know how I got here, but this is where I am and we need to do something. So we got on the phone with my primary care doctor and, we started to work it out. But the only people that knew were my primary care doctor and my wife. That's it. There was nobody at work that I could tell this to.
Oh, can I chime in there for a little bit with
you?
Yeah,
go for it.
Just sort of listening to, hearing you, share that, and thank you. And I'm sorry for your loss of your friend, right? He's 27 years old, a young guy. I really am sorry for your loss. I want to get into, asking you, like, when you were feeling that you were noticing there was changes in you, I was hitting the bottle a lot more. I stopped going out to social events with different people, and I heard you say, and then eventually they stopped asking, right?
Yeah.
More isolation. And then there's, you were work, right? You just diving into work constantly and then taking on a role of just being there for everybody else. If you did sit back and actually get to say to yourself, whoa, I need to slow down a little bit. But what was that feeling? If you can describe it, because you're really, really good at being able to share with us in detail, but I want to know the feeling inside of you. What was that feeling?
I was really lonely. And that's the way I can really put it. And I did not know at the time where I was, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
And I don't mean like I was disoriented or anything like that, but it's not until you start to take the camera and kind of look backwards and look at what you're going through that you actually go, oh, wow.
Yes.
Oh, you were in a really shitty place.
Yes.
I didn't know it at the time. I just thought life goes up and down. This is just an exceptionally down part. Yep. But that's, I really felt. And so here, I tell a lot of people this, honestly, and you start to feel broken. And I mean, you start to feel like unlovable almost. Like you asked about like knowing when I could slow down. I never had that ability in my life to do that. And I always looked at injuries as like someone else's method to slow me down. So I've had three significant injuries, one in 2008, one in 2009, and one in 2016. And I have always looked at those things as, I feel like somebody was telling me that you got to back off. You've got to slow down. Mm. And you know, a lot of people will generally start to view life as, oh my God, look at all these things that are happening to me. So I look at it a little different now. And I don't wish for any of those things to go away.
Yeah.
Because if that doesn't happen, that doesn't let me get to where I am. So things Absolutely. Didn't happen to me. They happened for me.
Yes.
And I think you just, it's just a shift of your mindset.
Yes.
And I
yes, we totally get it. I totally yep. understand it for sure. And I love that you're saying that. What basically you're taking your struggles, right, and learning how to be able to struggle well. Right.
Yep.
And,
yeah. I'm actually going to a course called Struggle Well.
Well,
in
yeah.
like 2 weeks.
Yes. Well,
familiar.
We're very familiar. Yeah, we have been through those classes too. You're absolutely going to love it. Yeah. Amazing, great. Amazing, amazing course. We interviewed the CEO of Boulder Crest Foundation, who's part of it, on the podcast, and absolutely amazing program.
I heard him talk a year plus ago in Nashville at the FOP Wellness Center, and I'd never heard of Boulder Crest, and I was like, and I listened to him for an hour and I'm like, I got to know more about this.
Yes, yeah. Absolutely.
And I have, you know, I've had friends that have actually attended there now. Mm. One of my friends who works outside of Baltimore she has been to the trainer program. She's bringing the 2-day course to Howard County Police.
Awesome.
So I'm going up there in 2 weeks.
Perfect. You're going to really, really enjoy it. It's an amazing course, for sure. So you're learning, you're actually putting that, what they're training, sort of into that action, into your life now by taking it instead of looking at your, what you've been through as a burden, right? Look at me, I'm a victim, right? Instead of using those terms, you were like, wow, there's a lot of growth in this. Right. Yep. For me, I'm, yep. you know, now I'm moving, I'm able to move on, I'm becoming a better person. Right.
Yes.
Can I ask you just one more question on that sort of part of your life, of your journey? Because I wrote down a couple of times, wife, it came up in a couple of times that I was writing down all the time through that journey. Right. Through that, you're working 60 hours a week and you're Jordan, you know, the May to October, right, where it's very, very busy. You're doing the polygraph. You're doing stuff after your shift is over. You're doing all this stuff. It's all work-related. I heard you say that, right? Where did your wife come into all of this play? Like, where was she?
From the get-go, she's always been incredibly supportive.
Yeah.
Even when she wasn't getting to see me very much, we would figure out ways that we could. Like when I'd work these like evening shifts, she would come to town and like meet me for dinner just because we're like living together. We're married, but we were like ships in the night because I would come home, go to bed, and then she'd get up, go to work. And so we're not spending any good time together. It's just, constant work.
Yeah.
She has understood almost from the get go. Like she's never been like, I need you to work less. So I met her literally 3 weeks before I got hired as a full-time police officer. And I remember telling her, very early on in dating, maybe like 7 or 10 days in, I'm like, listen, I need you to know what I want to do for a living. And what it means for you is that I'm not going to be home at night. And in the beginning, so I'd gotten out of the police academy and I started working for the city of Salisbury. And I'd work 2 weeks of nights and then 2 weeks of days. And she was making herself sick at night because she'd worry about me. Like, can I take care of myself? And, you know, is something going to happen to me? And one day she's like, don't take this like the wrong way. But I just kind of had for my own peace, just know that you'll be able to take care of yourself and you have friends that'll take care of you. Because like, I got to get some sleep because she was making herself so sick that she wouldn't sleep at night.
Yeah.
And I mean, that's not good for anybody.
Right.
So, you know, I was working all these overtime hours, and, you know, a lot of it, I would always say that it's for us because the money was good.
Yeah.
And she was always very supportive of that part. Mm-hmm. In the wintertime, the one deal that I made with her, and it's funny when you look back on it that I was able to do this for a lot of my years, is I would work day work in the wintertime. So we would have some semblance of a normal life. So I would work like 7 a.m. till 5 p.m.
Okay.
And I may not have weekends off, but I would maybe have a weekend day off. So,
yeah.
And at the time she was working like a normal person, and she would have Monday through Friday, 8 to 4.
Yeah.
You know, when the rest of us are working like nights, weekends, whatever.
Yeah.
So put that on top of, so all those hours plus FOP meetings and, you know, contract negotiation meetings and different social events, I would take her to everything I could. And she was never like, hey, you gotta get out of some of this stuff. She's always been incredibly supportive. And that's something I recognized very early on in my career.
Oh, you're so lucky. And so when you started, you know, when you got to a stage where you started noticing your alcohol, you know, your alcohol intake became more, right? More of, like, I'm sure there was behavioral changes in you. Was that noticed at home? Like, what, or was there? Like, was the behavior?
I was angry pretty much all the time. And I didn't know. I don't know that I knew why. And I like to say that my first, so here's what's interesting. My first experience with therapy, I didn't book my therapy appointment. My wife was already going to therapy. And it's funny because we don't have problems in our relationship or like home life, personal stuff. I had issues at work. She had issues at work. Unfortunately, sometimes that would bleed over into our home life. So she had said, hey, you know, you think about talking to somebody. I'm like, I don't need anybody. I'm good. So she is in
like
this,
every
this
first lady. Responder I know.
Yeah, yeah. Right. I'm fine. Everything's fine. Mm. You know, and what am I going to do? I'm going to slug back a couple more bourbons and everything will be perfect.
Yeah.
She's in the therapist's office and they call me and they're like, what are you doing tomorrow at 4? And I'm like, I don't have anything. And they're like, all right, you have an appointment. So that was the first time I went to therapy. And I, it was eye-opening, that some of the stuff that was just kind of coming out of me. And that was my first experience of like getting it out of you.
Yeah.
That if you keep it trapped in there for too long, eventually you're going to explode. Mm. And that was the first incident where I was starting to kind of let some of the steam out of the pressure cooker.
Yeah.
That's always the analogy that I use, that you have to find stuff that lets some of that pressure out, because at some point, if you just keep letting it build and build and build, it's going to explode.
Yeah.
And it's not going to come out in a good way, because that's just not the nature of it.
Right.
So I finally do, I go to therapy for a little while. And I would talk to her about, you know, the police world. And so what's interesting, incredibly nice lady. And I saw her for a couple of years, but she didn't necessarily understand the first responder life.
Yeah.
Let alone the police world. So I found myself, I would have to explain a lot of that. And she would be like, why don't you just go to your chief? And why don't you just say something right to your chief? I'm like, oh, that's not how it works.
Yeah.
Like, you know, it'll happen to me if I do that.
Yeah.
But I get it. If you don't have any experience, I think that's, you know, these are what you say. So anyway, so I had done that for a while with her, and it's not until after I have my surgery and the alcohol goes really like haywire crazy that I actually start taking medicine too. So I mean, still to this day, I actually see a therapist weekly, and it's different lady now. And I still take medicine every day. And I say that because I want people to understand that it's not a big deal. Like, why wouldn't you want to feel better?
Yes.
And it doesn't allow me to, it just takes the edge off. I would go through so much of my life in this kind of like teetering on exploding spot where I was just simmering angry.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And the smallest thing would happen and it didn't take much. And I was just like, ah. And it's funny when people see me now, because I didn't realize that outwardly I looked like that. I have people that'll tell me now, like, when they see me and they, you know, I talk about yoga and mental health and stuff like that, they're like, you're a different person than what I saw. And I was in a very different place.
Yeah.
2016, 17. Yeah. We're supposed to evolve. We're supposed to get better.
Just what you just shared there just a second ago about, like, it would only take before I would bark at somebody, right? I can tell you, there's so many first responders listening to you that are hearing themselves in what you just said.
Oh, yeah.
That are relating to you. Right, Jay?
Yeah. I think that that most or all first responders can relate to that. I read something the other day that said, you know, first responders, we maintain a poker face around all these horribly tragic and traumatic things. And then we explode when the pen breaks, right? And I could relate to that in the same way that I was able to just relate to what you were saying, and it all makes sense, which is why hopefully we soon see a time where the suggestion to go to a chief does make sense. Because when you talk about, like, you know, listening to you describe your storm and how it evolved, right? It's like all of those things are recognized at this point statistically as being rated as significant in how they will impact the common personality traits that we associate with those people that pursue a career in first response. Administrative betrayal. That's a big deal to people who by their nature say, no, I'm on the team. What do you need from me? I'm here to help and do anything above and beyond that I have to. When that's not reciprocated, that's felt a certain way at a depth by, you know, the common personality traits of a first responder, those ones that I admire, right? Like that I think many among us in those cultures do. So, you know, you talk about that and then, like, doing the polygraphs, like, that's trauma, right? That is witnessing.
I didn't learn until later on. Somebody used the word vicarious trauma, and I'm like, what's that mean? And they were like, you're taking on somebody else's stuff, and I'm like, oh my god, that's exactly what I'm doing.
Yeah,
and
I would come home sometimes, and I would like, Amy would look at me, and it's like, what's wrong? I'm like, you're not gonna believe the shit that people told me today.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then we cope in the ways that we do, and you know, there's an increase.
Do you know what I would do on those nights? I would literally come back, and I mean, these are people. I mean, like, people laugh sometimes there, but I would, like, come home and be like, well, somebody, another one tried to, like, have sex with their dog or something like that, and a lot of people are like, ha ha ha, but I mean, like, constant people are saying that. So I'm coming home, I'm like, oh. Another one, grab two beers out of the fridge and I go right to the shower and I take a shower and I drink two beers. Wow. And that was just like, I don't know that that's.
And that was just, and that just became your routine. You know what I mean? For a coping mechanism, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
To help you cope with that.
It's probably not healthy, but I would say in the context, it's normal, right? That's a normal reaction to abnormal circumstances of seeing, you know, some of the darker elements of a person's soul, many people's soul, and what that, you know, the impact that has on people. I think that it's a normal reaction, and that's why over time, hopefully in the relatively near future, we do see, you know, better understanding from administrators and chiefs that not only, you know, should they be endorsing the mental health and well-being of their first responders, but it's an organizational benefit to them. They'll have people coming back to duty. They'll have...
Hugely so.
Yeah.
Hugely so.
And because otherwise, like you said, eventually it comes out. We know that, right? So now it gets processed in a different manner. Somebody has an incident at work or an incident off work involving alcohol, whatever it is. Now the person, and then they end up being condemned and not helping. And that's really nobody's
fault. And it's funny. The only thing the police department knows how to do is discipline. Yeah. And all right, so you stepped out of line. Well, we're going to whack your hand.
Yeah.
And there's nobody that's coming in afterwards and saying, why? like what's going on in your head?
What got you here?
Do you ever? There's a poster and they always put it on t-shirts. And it always reminds me. So it's like the skull and crossbones and it's like on a little pirate ship and it says the beatings will continue until morale improves. Yeah. And that's exactly what it feels like. I am going to hit you until you feel better. Yeah. And you're just not going to get anything that way.
No, absolutely not. And it's, again, it's, you know, we say they teach you, you know, how to be a great cop, right? And all these constant trainings, but no one shows you or tells you how to look after yourself and take care, like self-care, right? Or each other.
That stuff that I teach now, and we'll get into the yoga and things like that. Yep. But, you know, I do want to say, because people have asked me, like, how much like mental health training did you get when you were in the police academy? And it wasn't a thing. You're a guy, you're a cop, you just suck it up, just deal with it.
Yes.
We had an hour. I remember telling a couple of people about this. We had an hour about police suicide in the academy and I didn't get it. I'm like, what? Why? I mean, this is like dream jobs. Why would folks kill themselves?
Yes.
And it's not until later in life. So when I get to Ocean City, one of the guys that I had started as a summer cop with, and he was a full-time cop right ahead of me, took his own life. Mm. And so we were actually impacted. And at the time he was 27 years old and he had, I don't know, maybe 3 years on, 4 years on total.
Wow.
And you know, we'll never know why. His name is Joe Kimball. And the anniversary of his death is just about 20 years ago now. And like, I still stays with me.
Yeah.
It's still a driving force. Behind what I'm doing is like how that, what that did to our police department and what it did to a lot of our, maybe our heads. That was incredibly early in my career.
Yeah. That's hard. Right. And a lot of departments don't know how to handle that type of a situation. Right. I think, you know, a lot of, I mean, I'm just going out from my own experience. Mm-hmm. When we lost Alex, I mean, there was no support from the department. There was from his buddies, right? His fellow officers. They still today, you know, are very supportive. But department did not know what to do. They took a major step back, and it was pretty a toxic environment to work for anyway within the department as far as administration were concerned at the time. But yeah, you're sort of left alone. So I imagine there's so many departments that don't know how to handle it because they don't experience this on a day-to-day basis until they do.
Right. And I'm going to share that I certainly had my own issues with, you know, trying to get mental health is more of a priority in police world and things like that. And I've certainly run up against my own roadblocks at this point with police leadership. And I think one of the stumbling blocks is, number one, money. Money's always a problem.
Sure.
in police and government. It's always, you know, people are like, we don't have money, we can't do it.
Yeah.
But I think the other part, and I think this is honestly the bigger part, is I think if these agencies start to accept that maybe there is a problem and maybe there's an issue with my rank and file cops, at some point they're going to have to look inward and they're going to have to say, what's wrong with me? And I think there ain't one of them that's willing to make that, that's willing to look inward and fix what's going on with themselves.
Yeah.
And I think that's a huge problem.
Yeah, absolutely, 100%. And I also believe like that it starts from the top down, right? The patrolmen, all of you officers that are working out in the field, and that's not only like police officers, but firemen, dispatch, whoever they're reporting to from the up the top, they have to foster a belief within the environment that all these men and women are working in that they are there to be able to support you. And not only that, but who are we kidding? I mean, officers, and first responders, firefighters, you're working a trauma job. Mm-hmm. That's what you deal with every day.
Yep.
So it's not a matter of, I mean, how can you think that someone's not going to have, human experiences, right, seeing that trauma that's every day, right? I know you said, well, the things that I saw on the job didn't really affect me. It was the isolation. It was the feeling lonely. It was all of that type of stuff that bothered me. Or we didn't support each other, right? We didn't look after each other on the job, right? Mm-hmm. They're the things that, like, really bothered you, that someone might not have your back. But I also feel that if there's a first responder that is going to seek help, Jay has heard me saying this before. I haven't said it in a while. But if a first responder goes to seek help within the administration, in the department, and he gets help. I'm just saying he, for just for reasons. But if he goes and seeks help and he gets it and is supported mm-hmm. by the department and he gets well and he comes back to work and there's another guy looking on and sees this happening, and he's going to have a belief that if I'm need help, I'm going to possibly receive the same, right? Yeah. Because I saw this guy happen and he's back at work now and he's doing great.
Yeah, yeah.
But on the other hand of that, the other side of that, if a first responder goes and seeks help in this department and he does not receive the support or help that he needs to get well from trauma of the job, and he's ridiculed or, all of chest disciplined, whatever it might be, and then another first responder is looking on and he sees mm-hmm. this guy being punished because he went and saw help, he's going to say, I'm not going to ask for help because guess what?
Hell no.
It's going to happen to me too. Right. And I need
it's
my
gonna
job.
Drive him. It's going to, rather than trying to get him up out of the hole, it's going to drive him all back farther deeper.
Yes.
And that's it's unfortunate. And yes. I feel like it's constant.
Yeah.
When I talk to people, they're like, I can't tell anybody in my agency
yes.
about this.
Yes.
Like, do you know what'll happen to me?
Yes.
And everybody is terrified of losing their job.
Yes.
They are more, they're like, that job is more important than they are.
Yes.
And that's just not true.
Yes.
And that took a long time for me to figure out. And, you know, when I wasn't a cop anymore, and I really did have that kind of like loss of identity. I don't know that I realized at the time kind of what I was going through and why I was actually having those feelings.
Yeah.
That had a lot to do with it because I had put so much into sure. this job. I had put so much of my blood, sweat, tears, and now that wasn't there anymore.
Yeah. And you lose that. You lose that part of identity and like, what do I do now? Mm-hmm. I've given so right. much of myself. I've given so much of me, but your job also takes away so much of you, right?
I've said that to quite a few people, like, it, like, you've left pieces of yourself
yes.
over your 20 or 25 sure. year career, but you've picked up things that you don't want.
Yes. Yes.
It's almost like the way they talk about crime scenes.
Yeah.
That, you know, you leave behind stuff, but you mm-hmm. take stuff with you. And,
yeah.
And I think we just have to prioritize. And I'm not saying that like everybody's got to go to a therapist every week. I'm not saying anything like that. I'm saying there's got to be ways that we can take care of ourselves, that they can do proactive things maybe weekly
yes.
for themselves, that they can go do something fun or go give a massage or something.
Wellness.
Whatever lights yes. them up is the term that I like to use.
Yeah. And we've been fortunate. We have had a few chiefs on here that have developed the type of mindset that we're talking about on the podcast, that are yeah. supportive of, you know, this movement towards mental health and well-being and first response. And you know, they endorse that within their departments. I agree with what you said a moment ago, Vance, about how eventually they're going to have to take a look inward, those departments that are still clinging to the old ideals, and they certainly will, right? At the end of February, there was 20 suicides reported within, you know, for first responders. This type of data, now that it's being collected, you know, it is undeniable, right? We have to ask why. Why is that happening at such a high rate?
Yeah.
And then we look at what we know about trauma, and the answer is very clear. And I also agree with what you said. One of the major hurdles or roadblocks where this conversation comes to a halt is money does matter, right? There's only so much in a budget, and how do we manage it? And sometimes, and that's even if you have the most well-intended department head or chief or administrator that would like to help, but I have a responsibility to this budget here. And I think eventually what's going to be realized is that we know why a large number of first responders don't report this stuff. We know why a large number of first responders do have these reactions, get caught in chaos, their lives become unmanageable, and, you know, they enter into that downward spiral. We know why it's happening. And when those people are offered help and they achieve and receive some type of recovery, that's going to be a financial savings. I truly believe that's what the spreadsheets will show as this movement goes on. Because, like we said a few moments ago, otherwise, what does it cost when somebody has, you know, an outburst with the public that's caught on camera and that has to be dealt with? How is that administrated and what's the bill? And so-and-so has a domestic or whatever these other unintended consequences that we pretend aren't related to trauma, right? But it's not happening the day they get on the job. It happens. It happens over time. And, you know, there's more and more people speaking up. I applaud you, Vance, for the good work that you're doing. And maybe you can tell us a little bit about how that came about. How did you find yoga and begin to find peace?
Yeah. I actually like to say that yoga found me. I kind of stumbled into it. So this is within a couple of days of Amy having this conversation with me. So we're in November of 2019. And I had done yoga for, you know, like recovery of injuries and things like that. I've done it around my house, and I've done it from like DVDs and VHS tapes. Sorry, I just dated myself, I know. I did not enter a yoga studio until November of 2019. It was within a couple of days of that conversation. And I'd had all these thoughts in my head of, you're not good enough and you're going to stand out and you're going to sweat all over the place. And I kind of put it aside and I was like, you know, I need something. I'm going to go check this out. And I didn't walk into that studio because I was like, I'm going to be enlightened or anything like that. I was just like, I'm going to do something different. And what I got was so much more. I finally felt like community again, where I had been isolating myself for so, so long. In the beginning, it was just, you know, it's a bunch of poses and you're just breathing. But I don't know that I had taken a deep breath in a really, really long time. And now I have somebody that's concentrating on it, and you have a lot of power in that. So when you can, you know, I've certainly preached this in classes. I've said it on some podcasts. If you can control your breath, you can control your life. You know, a lot of it has to do with being able to just kind of get in touch with what's going on in your body. When you can start to feel the tension come in, what is it you're doing to try to soothe your central nervous system? And so a lot of it has to do with being able to tap into what's going on in your body. So I don't do anything a little bit, and that's what my wife always likes, laughs at me about. I'm pretty all in. And so within 30 days of going to my first studio practice, I told her I was going to teach this to cops and firefighters and people like me.
Oh, wow.
So it took a couple months till I could get into a 200-hour teacher training program. So I did that. I finished in March of 21. And that's the base level yoga teacher training program. And it teaches you a lot about like history and philosophy and anatomy and things like that. And yep. Some sequencing of classes and stuff like that. And since that time, I've just started teaching studio classes, and I do some pop-up classes for first responders and veterans. I have what really took off for me was when I went to, it's a training program called Warriors at Ease, and it is a yoga and meditation program that was developed in the military, and it's for combat vets, but all of it is applicable to first responders. That's when things turned for me, that's the first time that I understood why this works for me and why it can work for other people. And so a lot of it had to do with the science of it. A lot of it had to do with, you know, working with folks that have PTSD or maybe symptoms of PTSD. So that's really when I didn't feel like I got that out of my initial program teaching. Yeah. So a lot of how I teach yoga classes, a lot of it comes from Warriors at Ease. Mm-hmm. And I've also been through Veterans Yoga Project. I just recently, I completed it's called iRest, and it is a guided meditation program. I just finished that like 2 weekends ago. So I started to integrate that. And then I just started, I can't stop. I told you I'm all in.
Yes.
I just started doing yoga for first responders. I just started doing their bridge program. So it's people that are already 200 hours certified. And this is just a bridge to get you to having a yoga for first responder certification. I literally started that last Monday. So I'm 1 week in of 8 weeks. But this is what I want to do. I will drive in the morning. So the Baltimore County and Howard County Police Departments have these peer meetings once a month.
Yeah.
And they do this joint one. They're two relatively big agencies that are outside of Baltimore. So I'm going to drive up in the morning. I'm going to tell them my story. I'm going to do my presentation, and then I'm going to teach them a yoga class. So I'm excited to see how many of them come.
Yeah.
And I've gotten some emails about people that are coming. So it sounds like, you know, we'll have a couple. And, you know, there's still a little stigma.
Yeah.
And, you know, folks are like, you want me to do what?
Yeah. Yeah.
And I'm like, listen, I'm not asking you to stand on your head. I'm not going to ask you to do the things that you've seen on Instagram. We're just going to move a little bit. We're going to breathe a lot, and we're going to listen to some music that you probably are going to recognize.
Yeah.
And, you know, I just want you to, you know, kind of check in with your mind, and we'll do that in the beginning. We'll do that probably about midway through, and then we'll do it at the end. And there's two questions that everybody that comes for the first time, I always ask them the same two things. I'm like, tell me tomorrow how your body feels, and I want to know how you sleep tonight.
Yeah.
Because most people after their first yoga class, they'll get a really nice night of sleep. Yeah. Because that's the first time in a long time that they've actually been able to tap into their parasympathetic nervous system.
Yeah.
And actually start to come into that rest and digest and start to settle everything down.
Yeah.
And truth be told, that's where you have to be if you're going to process anything.
Yeah.
And this is what I mean when I say learning the science of it and why it works and why it's good for your brain. Yeah. Is when you live in that fight or flight brain and you're constantly on and you constantly think you're under attack, your body doesn't function like that. And your body's not supposed to function like that. So in order to move through life a little more comfortably, you have to settle things down, settle the brain down, settle the central nervous system down. Yeah. And that's yoga helps. Meditation can certainly help.
Breath work. All of it.
All of those things. And, you know, just because this is what worked for me, I mean, I'm not going to say that yoga is for everybody.
Yeah.
This is my thing. And yes. I'll share it with anybody that wants to try it. But, you know, a lot of people are always like, what's your takeaway? And I'm like, find your thing. Do something that is not your job. Find a cool hobby. I don't care if you collect stamps. I don't care if you take pictures of birds. I mean, whatever it is.
Yes, absolutely.
Just don't let your fascination be your job.
Yes. But I also really believe that yoga, breathwork, meditation, all of those, that connection that's connecting you with your inner self, right? For you to be able to control your breath, right? When you put that into a context, I'm just after trying to paint a picture of a first responder, firefighter coming in after a house fire, and they're all worked up, they're bursting with adrenaline, right? And they need to come down off that, from that, right? Mm-hmm. Some way. And being able to have a tool like yoga, breath work, meditation, to be able to do some stretching that releases those, you know, those chemicals, right? George, do you want to chime in?
It's self-regulation.
To be able to regulate.
Almost like if you think of like an infant, that when you get to a point, and listen, we didn't have kids, so I don't totally know what I'm talking about, but you want babies to learn how to self-soothe.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And I think as adults, we were never taught those skills, and sometimes we adapt to bad skills, like for me, booze,
alcohol,
and a lot of it, and it was socially acceptable in most first responder worlds to drink a lot. And if you get drunk, you're probably a lot of fun. And that's just what it is. Unfortunately, that fun was actually masking some pretty deep, dark pain.
Right.
So, yeah, I want to I'd like to teach them ways to better cope with stress. And look, everybody can be chill, calm. We're sitting in office chairs right now and we're just sitting here talking.
Yeah.
But what if we were to, so how do we make this a little bit harder? Like, what if we got into like some difficult poses and like your body is actually like maybe, trembling a little bit and you get introduced to your breath at that point. And you take a deeper breath in and you actually start to notice that the muscles start to maybe open up, maybe start to gain a little space. Mm-hmm. And then you learn that just because I'm trembling, I'm still perfectly fine. I still perfectly have it together in my mind.
Yeah.
So that lesson that you learn on the mat is so much bigger than the 60 minutes you spend in yoga.
Yeah.
Because you're taking that and then you put it out into the world. So the next time that you face some sort of conflict, some sort of chaos, you're like, oh yeah, I have this tool that's already
this
with
tool.
Me.
Yes.
Yeah. And that's what it is, you know, whether it's beautiful. You know, yoga, breath work, all of these things that absolutely do activate the parasympathetic nervous system, and our jobs, you know, activate the sympathetic nervous system and put us in that fight or flight. When you talk about like, well, you drink and then you have fun, but really we're covering up this deep dark secret for reasons that make sense, right? The human body does not like to experience physical pain. And when we do, we'll try to remove ourselves or alleviate that pain immediately. And there's responses that are less obvious until maybe you begin to heal and achieve some wellness, bring some wellness into your life. That happened to help us avoid that emotional pain as well. Mm-hmm. And when you see someone like, this is so interesting to me, and I think so it's valuable to the culture and so needed because they get those tools. I'm doing a clinical internship right now at the Mass Bay Vet Center over in Somerville. They're a program affiliated with Volunteers of America. And I just did breath work with them for the first time a couple weeks ago. And it was like, I had to prep them for it for a couple weeks because I didn't think anybody, you know what I mean? We're doing a group and I'm not sure what the reaction is going to be. So I'm trying to, you know, make them be okay with it before we do it. And we did. There was a couple of those veterans that I believe had that moment that you're talking about and that I can identify with, where I took my first breath, right? Like, I mean, mm-hmm. I've been breathing, but I took my first breath that made a difference in my soul. I took my first breath that relieved tension and stress, and I was absolutely aware that it was transformational. Oh, my first breathing session, right? But I couldn't ignore the fact that I was in a different state of mind, a different perspective than when I had started, you know, doing this meditation or this breathing. And once you have that, that's that tool that you talk about that you walk away with. Now there's the awareness. I don't have to walk around with this tension.
I just want to chime in as far as, you know, that breath work and meditation. I was someone that was always cardio, that sweat queen in the gym, right? And that's how I sort of, that was sort of my therapy from whatever of the day. When we lost Alex, I think meditation found me, to be honest with you. I did not go seeking it. I never thought I would be able to, you know, sit still for a minute, never mind, you know, 10 minutes or 15 minutes. And breath work, I mean, that was something that I would never have paused for a moment to even consider that it would be useful for me. And I don't know how it happened, but it found me. That's all I can say. Mm. It found me. And it's been 5.5 years that I've sort of embraced a new way of being able to cope, right, with stressors of everyday life, never mind going through a traumatic, loss in our family, and sure. being able to deal with that. But just even through everyday life, you know, I run a little cafe here, and I would say I used to get so stressed with even doing the staff schedule, you know, just even the simple little things on a weekly basis. And I don't stress about that anymore. I just take a deep breath and say, what will be, right? And it will all figure itself out. So don't let myself get stressed over those little things. And it's because of learning how to meditate and slow down and be aware of what's going on with me, and how I can calm myself down and regulate myself. And it's been so useful for me. So I totally agree with you, what you just have to say there and what Jay just said about that, you know, breath work and meditation. It's a beautiful thing. And changed I do remember. Life, sure. Yeah, it changed my life too, for sure. Changed your life?
Yes, ma'am. Sure did. Changed my life.
Yeah. And it changed yours, Vance, right, too?
Oh, it sure did.
Yeah. So where are you going now with it? Where do you plan to go, like, you know, in the next year, in the next 2 years, 3 years? Okay. What's your plan for yoga rescue, for first responders and with veterans, whatever, whoever you want to bring it to? Where are you planning on going with that?
So I want to – all right, let me back up. Let me tell you what I'm doing right now. So I teach my normal classes. I teach at a counseling office every Thursday evening, and then I teach at a studio every Saturday morning. That's open to anybody. I also do a monthly class at a local community college. That is a free yoga class. It's at Chesapeake College. It's actually next week, March 13th. So I do some pop-up events here and there, and, you know, I teach some private clients, but where I really want to go is I want to teach other people like me how to teach yoga. I got into this thinking that I wanted to teach people like me to actually go through the poses and go through a class. But, you know, there gets to be a point where, you know, in order to really have impact, I got to kind of teach them maybe what I know and what I've found to be successful. So in order for me to start a yoga training program, I need to have 500 hours under my belt of learning. So I actually started my 300 hour yoga teacher, my advanced teacher training. I started it at a place called Guiding Wellness Institute, and it's down in Fayetteville, North Carolina. So I've been twice, and I've done two online, so I've got two more left to do. And it's it's Fayetteville, North Carolina, is a 6-hour drive for me. It's certainly worth it. I go down there for the weekend a couple times. It's a lot of homework. It's a lot of introspective stuff, a lot of reading, and a lot of like coming to terms with certain things in your life. And then what you want to share. It's funny, when I teach classes now, it's almost a little bit therapeutic, because I end up talking about whatever's going on in my life, and kind of telling them what I need to tell myself. So sometimes I don't have a plan for what I'm going to do in class, and I just kind of let it go with whatever pops up in my head and just take a breath and here we go. So eventually I hope to have my 500 hours completed by the end of next year. And then we'll see. Because I got hurt, I was moved into a police and fire dispatcher role. So I'm not completely retired yet.
Okay.
I moved over a year and a half ago into our police and fire dispatch center, and I have a year until I can retire. I can retire June 1 of 25. However, if you're familiar with drop, I can do an extra 3 years, stay on. I can make a little extra money to do that. So I realistically am going to work 4 years more.
Okay.
And so I have like a real full-time job.
Yeah.
Yoga's still my side hustle.
Yeah.
And at some point, that'll probably be more. I don't have, beyond that at this point. You've heard the end of my business plan. I probably need to go to a business plan class or something, because I know how to teach a yoga class, but then there's a business part to it, which
still got
to learn all that stuff.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like that. Hey, 4 years, right? That's going to give you plenty of time to be able to learn how to now develop a business model, right? For what you want to put out there. And it really, really sounds like I can envision when you were talking about that, like I would want to teach people how to be able to do what I do and take it back to the departments, right? I can see that happening, and I would love that to happen. That, you know, again, making wellness part of a normal, not just we'll bring in this yoga instructor to do a 1 day class and check off the box mark. You know what I mean? That it's part of a normal within that culture,
let's integrate it. And let's maybe have a teacher in there that can give weekly classes.
Yes.
That would really be, cause I'm one guy, you know what I mean? Yeah. Like I can only teach so many people. And my wife had been after me for a while. She's like, you should really start a YouTube channel and you should do some classes there. So I've started to do that. There's a 15-minute class. There's a 30-minute class. There will be more in the future as I have a little extra time to make them, but those are all completely free and anybody can log on to those. Or it's Yoga Rescue with Vance. That's my YouTube.
I love that you have to say that. Yeah. I'm going to get on.
Check it out. And then I actually have a couple where I just break down poses. So they're like literally a minute long and I just talk about one pose. Just if you ever wondered about a certain thing, like here's my take. And just because, I really do try to take, I know my people and I know that there's a stigma for yoga because they think it's going to be real hippy dippy.
Yeah.
And it doesn't have to be. I take a lot of that out. I'm still a little hippy dippy, but you know, no, I always say like no robes, no banging tambourines, no chanting. So, but it's just movement, music, mindfulness. Those are the things you're going to come out of a class with me with.
Yeah. Beautiful. And I think betterment, right. I think that's definitely coming out. I would love to take a class with him. Would you?
Yeah. I just wrote it down. I'm definitely going to check out I'll probably do it privately when nobody can see me awkwardly trying to get into the poses, but I'm definitely going to check it out.
I will certainly throw this out. I did a podcast about a month ago for First Help, and I am doing a yoga class for them through Zoom on Friday because they were like, we want to know what it's like. So I'm like, how about we just set something up? So I'll make the same offer. You'll want to do that? Let's just figure out a good time and I'll teach you through Zoom.
I love that.
Sounds great, man.
I'm very familiar with First Help. First Help was an organization who helped our family after the loss of Alex. So we're very familiar with them. So
yeah.
I love that you're doing that with them. And it's a great way to think. But I love that. I mean, why not even send up like a Zoom thing for first responders within their departments if they were open to it? I mean, there's lots and lots of different options. But I think the fact that you are a first responder, you're a police officer, and that this modality has helped you, it, as you said, it has changed my life. Mm. That's a big deal.
That's a big deal.
And to think that, you know, now you can start to move through life in a much more peaceful way and still be a first responder, right? Dispatches is still a first responder, whether you feel it or not. I don't know if you're doing it.
100%.
Right? You're taking that call.
It's funny that I have this background of police and then I bring it into the dispatch center and they put me on the police radio like almost immediately. So I did that all last summer and then they taught me how to be a fire dispatcher. So now I do one or both of those things throughout the day.
Yeah.
So every day is a little bit different. Yeah. Our summers are definitely busier than our winters, but I definitely landed in a really good spot. I work with an incredible shift of people and we talk about this stuff openly and we just kind of talk about our problems. And I just think that was very different than when I was in the police world.
Yeah.
And you know, cause you know, in the police, you just, you had to put up this facade of everything's fine, everything's good all the time. And you almost kind of wore this mask.
Yes.
And nobody knew what the true you was.
Yes.
And, I don't feel like I have to do that anymore.
I love hearing that, because it's just someone that's listening to you is going to be like, wow, am I putting up this mask? Have I got this mask? Do people really know who I am? Right. I mean, that's what our listeners are going to get from you, and maybe possibly start on their own healing journey, and maybe take up some yoga. So I love that. I love this conversation tonight. I mean, this is something that I know I'm into, and I know he's totally into also, because it has helped us both, right, in different ways, and on our own healing journeys for what we've gone through in our lives. So, but we really appreciate having you here tonight, Vance, and I look forward to this getting out to our listeners, which will be this Friday, by the way.
Okay. I was going to ask when you thought it would be released. That's fantastic.
It's going to be this Friday for sure, and we look forward to getting it out.
It's a pleasure meeting you too, man. I love what you're doing. I really believe in it, although my exposure to yoga is minimal. I meditate every day, and that's something, if 10 years ago you told me I was going to be doing that, I'd be like, oh, you need mental health help. I'm not meditating.
It's so funny to me, just kind of like how we evolve and kind of like how our careers unfold. And if you told me, so, you know, for me to get a job as a police officer, I'm sitting in a chief's office in December of 2000. And I'm telling them why I want to be a police officer. And, you know, they always ask, like, well, you know, where are you going to see yourself at the end of the career? I mean, how on earth would I have ever thought being like, I think I'm going to teach yoga to cops.
There's no way. Yeah. Yes.
And you'd be like, I changed my mind. We're not going to hire you.
I hear you. I would have never dreamt of, 5.5 years ago that I'd be doing this. You know, what we're doing, and we're putting on a very, very big event here on a Saturday evening for first responders and families, right? I asked you about your wife earlier on. I'm a big believer that families get left out of the whole scenario, and they're a big part of your career, right? Whether they want to be or not. So we're doing a whole sort of readiness workshop for first responders and families, and we're bringing in this whole crew of professionals who are going to present what they do, trauma therapists. We have, you know, some a program that helps first responders get through some struggles. We have equine therapy. We have mindfulness coaches coming. We have financial coaches coming. And they're all going to present and also be able to share with families, hey, these are the resources that are all available for your first responder in a time of need, right? And a lot of times the first responder is not talking about what they're going through when they go home, right? And but the wife or the spouse notices those behaviors in the form of alcohol and irritability and isolating away from their families and stuff like that, but they don't know how to interact with them or help them. So we're hoping that a little bit more awareness on the family side and a bit of education from the professionals that are coming, we'll start to be able to take away a little bit of anxiety. So if it does come to a crisis situation or something that's an issue in the home, well, then they won't be saying, you need help. Who can I call to help you? I don't know who. Right. They're going to be able to say, hey, I was there that night. I saw that person and I know who to give a call. So it's going to be a great event this weekend. So I look forward to seeing more of you on YouTube, because I'm going to check you out. And we're definitely going to follow you a lot more, Vance. And thank you so much for joining us tonight.
I just took a little quick picture of us.
Oh, you did?
let me see if that looked good. Yeah, that looks good. Fantastic.
Perfect.
Okay.
Yeah. Thank you so much.
This has been a pleasure.
Vance shared with us his struggles as a police officer in Ocean City, Maryland. He talked about feeling that he was carrying other people's struggles and pain around with him, and how that led to his drinking more and more as a way to cope. Vance shared intimately with Linda what thoughts were going through his mind when he started to have suicidal ideations. He had a plan, but thankfully, he eventually chose to share with his wife what he had been feeling, and then he sought help. Yoga has helped Vance learn how to regulate his nervous system, control his breathing. It's a practice he wants to take into the first responder field to help others. If you're a first responder who's struggling and you think that yoga might help you, check out Vance's YouTube channel at Yoga Rescue with Vance Rowe. And if you're a first responder who's struggling and you're not sure what might help, as always, you can call one of the Hope Lines and we'll guide you to helpful resources. Those numbers are 781-817-3357 or 617-657-9108. At one point in the podcast, I mentioned introducing a breathing exercise to a group of veterans. I had that experience at the Volunteers of America's Mass Bay Vet Center, where I've been doing a clinical internship. And they're looking to hire a full-time mental health clinician to work with their veteran population. I've had a wonderful experience there. I can't say enough good things about the staff, the culture, and the work that they do. If you're interested in applying for that position, you can contact me at j.hopebeyondthebadge@gmail.com or check out the career opportunities on their website at voamass.org.